Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening one of my favorite guests, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we were going to sort of talk about some of the things that are going on in the world today. So I'm sort of going to let you just take the lead, and I'll just tag along behind.
Okay. There are several things going on. Number one, they're still talking about the lack of weapons of mass destruction being found in Iraq. Also, a couple of weeks ago, actually, really just about a week and a half ago, you had a meeting of the September 11th Independent Commission. That's another subject in the news. In addition, of course, we have our rejoining of UNESCO with a rather unique perspective from our own federal government on that. And another topic we can get into are the promotion by President Bush of an increased number of guest workers, as they're called. And a fifth topic would be, of course, what's happening in the current presidential race. Do you have any preferences to which one of them you want to start with?
Well, let's start with the first one. Now, let's talk about the weapons of mass destruction. And what we're seeing, now the administration is saying, gee, shucks, you know, there was why we were wrong. How could this have been? Well, let's have an investigation to find out how this was wrong and why we got the wrong information. When, of course, it should be so obvious, after read Paul O'Neill's book, that they were already planning on attacking Iraq, at least in February of the year 2001, because Paul O'Neill tells about going to the meetings at the White House where they're planning on attacking Iraq. We know, of course, that decision had been made long before that by Rumsfeld and Cheney. If you go to the Project for the New American website, that's newamericancentury.org website, and look up the 1998 letter that they sent to President Clinton, signed by Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all the others, members of the Project for the New American Century. They wanted the war at that time. I think it should be pretty obvious that they were looking for an excuse to go to war. And I wouldn't blame the intelligence agencies. I would blame the people who wanted to go to war and were looking for an excuse to go to war.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, as George Tenet was saying today. And I, of course, like you, have some questions about Tenet, but he said the intelligence community never said that there was a, quote, imminent threat. Now, when you confront the administration, they'll say, well, we didn't use the word imminent, but constantly they're replaying on television, on Nightline and other programs, speeches by Rumsfeld and Cheney, and Cheney using words like, there can be no doubt, and they pose grave consequences.
And
these,
we really can't wait any longer.
Right.
I mean, it could almost, like, it could happen almost any day.
That's
that
right.
Was the justification. It could happen almost any day. But the thing was, they wanted an excuse to go to war. And I don't think that they're really being forthright when they say, well, we're going to investigate to see what happened. They know jolly well what happened. There weren't any weapons there. They knew there weren't any weapons there. But they wanted a war. That's just like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was phony, like the sinking of the Maine, which was phony, advanced knowledge of exactly what was going to happen at Pearl Harbor. The tragedy is that American boys are dying over in Iraq today in a war that was planned long before George Bush ever got into office. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. You pick up the story, Dennis.
Okay, following on with what you said, the first, second World War, the Gulf of Tonkin, and so on, actually the first Gulf War there was a debate with George Bush and Brent Scowcroft and Colin Powell and James Baker. And when Colin Powell and Baker were saying, well, let's see, go over to Europe and see NATO and maybe we can negotiate Saddam's removal from Kuwait, both Scowcroft and Bush chimed in, but we have to have this war. They were actually afraid that Saddam would have withdrawn his forces from Kuwait so they wouldn't have an excuse to go to war. And so what you had at that time was Paul Wolfowitz and some others at the time of the first Gulf War beating the drum for the removal of Saddam, including by military force. And at first it was more or less rejected as an extreme measure, but they kept pursuing it, as you said, through the Project for the New American Century in 1997 and then onwards. Of course, they would write to various President Clinton first, and then President Bush, saying, this is what we need. We need a permanent military presence in the Gulf region to protect Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and oil and Israel and all of this. But they said Saddam, he just offers an immediate justification for this. And so they were, as you indicated, looking for an excuse. And so when they get this intelligence, you had a lot of caveats in there from the intelligence community, like when they saw this truck and they thought it could be some sort of weapons of mass destruction removal device, they always put it in those terms. Well, this could be, but when it got to the upper levels of the administration, you had Colin Powell sitting at the UN and actually showing pictures and say, here is a, and he used very dramatic words. He didn't use any caveats like, well, we sort of think this might be, but then again, maybe it isn't. He didn't use any of that language, which you found in the original intelligence reports, and because that was their effort to beat the drum. As Wolfowitz said, they looked at a lot of strategies, but they focused on the weapons of mass destruction because that would be the most extreme, that would rally the most support, they thought, for an attack. And they actually, it was more or less a fait accompli, because a lot of people, including myself, could see this coming in advance. That what they were doing was placing themselves, if you look at it objectively, never mind, you know, some sort of conspiracy or something, but just objectively, if a president sticks X number of hundreds of thousands of troops over in the Gulf, then he's either got to withdraw them or use them. And Bush placed himself in a position where he wasn't going to withdraw them because then he would appear to be a coward. He didn't want to leave them through the summer months.
Hold on that thought just one more moment, and we'll be right back with you here. All right, fine. And of course, we're talking about the plan to take us into a war with Iraq, and they had to have an explanation for the American people. You had to go back and say, study Vietnam. They wanted a war in Vietnam. Why? It was a distraction to take our attention away from what was happening here at home as we introduced socialism, the great society. And if you question that, you need to read the January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, where McGeorge Bundy explains why we were in Vietnam. And he says the road forward at home, talking about socialism, is by persistence in Vietnam, and if we pull out, there'll be strong reaction against our domestic policies. And so they staged a phony incident, the Gulf of Tonkin, to get us into the war, but you had to have an excuse for the American people. And here again we see, as far as going to war with Iraq, they had to have an excuse, and of course it was those weapons of mass destruction that threatened at any moment to be unleashed, either directly by Saddam Hussein or turned over to the terrorists so that they could be used against us. And unfortunately, so many of the American people really believe they were telling the truth.
Right, and what you look at is to see whether something is a sincere effort or real or staged is you look at what else is going on. So, for example, in Vietnam, while they say, oh, look, you know, the Tonkin Gulf, our boat was attacked, and of course it really wasn't. It was, a fib that was told in that raid. You look during the war, and you see that if we really have this enemy of North Vietnam, which was at that time largely being supported by the Soviet Union, to some extent by Communist China, but largely by the Soviet Union, then if we were really, really serious, number one, we wouldn't have Ford Motor Company building trucks for the Soviets at the Kama River Truck Factory.
And we wouldn't be providing the money for the Kama River Truck Factory. We financed that largest truck factory in the whole world for the Russians during the Vietnam War while they were supplying trucks to North Vietnam.
Right. Tremendous amount of loans, still going to the Soviets, so that looked very suspicious right from the get-go. Same thing with this, the current war against Saddam. If you look at what happened to that, you see sort of a background going into it. And it's not just Saddam, it's also in Afghanistan. You remember we talked about that IndiaReacts.com website where they actually had this little map and they showed how the Soviets and American troops were amassing up in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and so forth, and we literally sort of read the Taliban a riot act that if they didn't do certain things, we would invade. And what's unique about that isn't just PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, but a year prior to that, the invasion of Afghanistan and the removal of the Taliban, you had the James Baker Institute, along with the CFR, forming these study groups. And at that time, they were saying that, well, you know, we have to have stability in Afghanistan to run that pipeline down through there and over to Pakistan and India and get this oil over to the West. And, gee, wouldn't it be good if the Taliban wasn't around and you had a more stable regime? You know, and Ken Lay of Enron was on that, I think he was like chairman of that study group. Same thing with Saddam and Iraq. 3 months or so before the attack, which many people thought was coming, probably, but these people actually had some time, you know, post-Iraq plan for development. And they went through 3 months in advance, again, the same sort of scenario, that afterwards you could have these oil deals and a secure route and with Saddam removed and so forth and so on. So you see the strategizing going on by these powerful groups of people way in advance, and that pushed the envelope so that at the critical moment, Bush, if this were objective, and, you know, I have my doubts and all, but if it were objective, just, you know, President X, he had himself in a situation where he either had to use the troops, let them stay there over the summer and burn up or whatever, or withdraw them, which he couldn't do because then he would look like a paper tiger. So it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that we were going to attack Iraq.
No, we had to have an excuse for the American people. They always have to have an excuse somehow or other, whether it would be the Gulf of Tonkin incident or the sinking of the Lusitania in the First World War, or as in the Second World War, the attack on Pearl Harbor, which we knew was coming, and we specifically did not warn the commanders at Pearl Harbor, tell them to put their ships to sea, which would have meant there really wouldn't have been a target for the Japanese to have hit. Instead, we left the fleet there, knowing the attack was coming, and anybody who doubts that will be glad to send you copies of the pages from Secretary of War Stimson's diary, which I got at Sterling Library at Yale, where Secretary of War Stimson talks about going to the White House, meeting with five people. General Marshall was there, Frank Knox was there, Admiral Stark was there, the President was there, and I think, did I mention George Catlin Marshall? Anyway, and the President said, this was the 25th of November. The attack will come any day, perhaps next Monday, but under any circumstances. The question is, how will we get into this war, get the Japanese to fire the first shot, and, of course, have as few casualties as possible? Those are his exact words. And anybody would like to see the pages from the diary, we have them. It was all set up ahead of time. They specifically did not warn Admiral Kimmel. In fact, he tried to put his fleet to sea. They ordered it back. Why? Because they needed a target. Had the target not been there, the Japanese wouldn't have attacked.
The administration at the time, although people didn't pick up on it, sort of let it slip that what they were doing, because when somebody afterwards asked, well, why didn't you, you know, send an immediate notice to them by a particular venue, and they said, well, no, we sent it by Western Union, and the fellow, you know, here's the planes dropping the bombs, and he's riding up on his bicycle. And the reason they gave was, well, you know, if the Japanese knew that, they would know we had broken their code. All right, what I say to that is, so what? You know, the worst would have happened was the Japanese say, we're found out, and we're turning around and go home.
Now, but you see, I don't know how many people in the audience remember that recent film, Pearl Harbor, with Ben Affleck. And,
right.
And exactly as you said, you know, the story is there, and the attack's underway, and the men are killed, and the planes are in. And here's Admiral Kimmel sort of looking at this, not understanding what's happened. And here comes this little boy on a bicycle, you know. He's from Western Union. He's bringing the war warning from George Catlin Marshall, who would not send it by, any of the military means. He wouldn't send it by radio. he sends it by Western Union and arrives about 30 minutes after the attack. They left those boys there to die. And that is unconscionable, but a lot of the people justify it saying, well, we had to get into the war. After all, we had to stop Adolf Hitler, and we had to stop the Japanese. We needed to rally the people behind the administration. The tragedy, and what's really wrong with that story, is that if you go into the background of the funding of Adolf Hitler, you'll find he was largely funded by American and British corporations. And if you read my syllabus, The Iraq, The Untold Story, you'll see the references from Professor Quigley's work, and Professor Quigley was Bill Clinton's mentor, telling about how this small little group, which was the prelude to the Council on Foreign Relations, the British counterpart of the Council, was encouraging Adolf Hitler at every turn to take the Sudetenland, to take the Alsace-Lorraine, to take Austria, and encouraging, financing him, doing everything they could to get him into a more militaristic mode. And then, of course, when he attacked Poland, he couldn't believe that the English, which had backed him at every turn and encouraged him at every turn, suddenly were going to go to war with him.
Right. And another way to look at this that fits with what you're portraying, the scenario of First World War, Second World War, Vietnam, and so forth, is the same sort of situation that is set up. For example, when you start propping up, let's say, the despotic rural family of Saudi Arabia, you can pretty much anticipate that down the road somebody's going to resent that. It's very much like in Nicaragua and Guatemala and other places where we were propping up some sort of dictator, and then, you know, we're supposed to be very surprised that the communists get a foothold there among the peasants. Well, same thing with the current situation, and in World War II, which you were just talking about, Americans have this sort of just one-way view of things. Now, I'm not going to defend Japan because they were doing some nasty things on the mainland of Asia, and they were not very nice at all. However, what would Americans do if we were blockaded in terms of getting our natural resources and oil? We'd resent that. We'd act militarily. So basically what FDR did, sort of not so gently, was form a blockade around Japan whereby they couldn't get various natural resources. Now
Oil, they couldn't survive.
Right. And so what would the reaction of the U.S. be to that? Now, in the current situation, one of the things you hear the administration talking about is the evil Saddam Hussein and how very, very bad he is in gassing his own people, the Kurds. Okay, again, I'm not defending him. It is a horrible, horrible thing, and he shouldn't have done it. However, the rest of the world sees this as sort of a double standard because, number one, it was during wartime. The Iraqis were at war with the Iranians, and the Kurds, a lot of them, were supporting the Iranians. They wanted separation and their own independent state or alignment with the Shiites in Iran and so forth. And so they're gassed. Very, very bad thing. A population there.
But who gave Saddam the chemical weapons to use on the Kurds and on the Iranians?
Right. But also what they say, the people, let's say, of Iraq or whatever, say, well, what's the difference between that and you bombing Nagasaki and Hiroshima, a civilian population? So, and I'm not, you know, getting into whether that was good or bad or should or shouldn't or whatever, but as you've indicated that I think all they want, they'd already offered to surrender in advance of that.
Five times over 7 months or seven times over 5 months. They repeatedly tried to surrender and we wouldn't let the Japanese. Were through, they knew they were through, and we continued the war and the invasion of Okinawa and of Iwo Jima and the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The only two Christian cities in Japan at the time, that was totally unnecessary.
Right, and so the rest of the world, apparently Americans don't see this way, but the others in the world look at that and say, well, wait a minute, you know, isn't this a double standard? And that's one of our problems.
I agree with you totally, Dr. Cuddy, and of course, but I think the biggest thing about talking about Saddam's use of chemical weapons is that we gave him the money, we gave him the chemical and biological weapons. And that's why we had to destroy the bunkers at Kamishium, because if they were filled with American chemical weapons that had been given to Saddam Hussein, the wicked Saddam Hussein, who was killing the Kurds and killing the Iranians.
And Rumsfeld it legit.
Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're talking about, well, lots of things. But right now we're just talking about how we were manipulated into the war in Iraq. And once you get into the war, then you have an impossible situation. Your boys are there. There's no stability in this society. If we were to pull out, there'd be a civil war, which would be equally bloody to anything that Saddam Hussein had done between the 60% of the people who are Shia Muslims and the 35% that are Sunni Muslims, and the Christians would be slaughtered and the Kurds would be slaughtered. And so we're trapped here in this situation. The United Nations doesn't want to come in into this tar pit. And how many more men are going to die? And not only that, we've lost 400 men dead in Afghanistan, 500 and perhaps 30, 40, 50 by now in Iraq. But we've had over 11,000 casualties. Many of these people are seriously ill, and some of them have died as casualties for supposedly unknown reasons. I think a lot of this is depleted uranium exposure. But the government, of course, denies that there is a problem with depleted uranium, and our boys will continue to die from it. As we know, of the 695,000 men who went to the first Gulf War, probably in the neighborhood of about, we know it's at least over 200,000 have disability claims with the Defense Department, and it's suggested that another 200,000 have claims that the Defense Department is ignoring. Somewhere between 200,000 and 400,000 of those 695,000 boys are sick, and a number of them have died. Well over 11,000, some people say as many 40,000 young, healthy men who went overseas to fight for freedom have now lost their lives here in America.
Yes. It's a real tragedy, and one of the things that I've written about is that when one miscalculates your enemy's strategy, this literally does cost lives. And what has happened and what is happening is awful, not just in the sense of loss of life and thousands wounded, but it defies common sense. And that's what I'd like your listeners to just think about for a minute. Let's assume that you're President Bush, and let's assume that you're very honest in your intentions, and let's assume that you say, well, you know, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, but he's a liar, we can't take a chance, we've got to invade. All right, let's just assume that. Now, there's problems with that, but let's assume that. Still, this is an amazingly incompetent effort that's gone on. First off, the first President Bush had about 600,000 troops just to remove Saddam from Kuwait, never mind occupying a country about the size of California. He had 600,000 just to remove Saddam. We, for some reason, thought with a couple of 100,000 troops, we could not only remove Saddam, we could invade and occupy the country and police it, or whatever you want to call it, afterwards. That doesn't make any sense at all. Secondly, you have to anticipate there would be some sort of resistance afterwards, especially when it didn't make any sense for Saddam to send, you know, his 300,000 regular army, 100,000 Republican Guard out into the desert so we could bomb them to the Stone Ages from 30,000 feet. Okay, so you have to anticipate there's at least the possibility of this sort of hit-and-run guerrilla attack that we've had. That means you have to have far more troops from somebody, because you're having to disperse. Once you get to Baghdad, you got to police Mosul, you got to police Kirkuk, you got to police Basra. I mean, you have to spread your troops all over the place. 200,000 people are not going to be able to cover all of Iraq. And the scenario goes on and on, so that even the Iraqis start to become suspicious. They, you know, wait a minute here. Are they doing this simply so they have an excuse to stay longer?
Hold that thought for a moment. Okay, Dennis, please go right ahead. Saying maybe even the Iraqis are saying, hey, what's really going on here?
Right, they're wondering if we didn't put so few people in this situation so that there would be this instability, so that would allow us to stay even longer. Secondly, they ask themselves, to them, very logical questions. If we're an advanced nation, the U.S., so that we can send a Tomahawk cruise missile from hundreds and hundreds of miles and hit a precise target, you know, the size of a house, from that distance, how come within a month we couldn't even have the electricity running, you know, or the water purified and so forth? So there's just a whole lot of questions that, even if one doesn't believe in conspiracy theories, surely if you're President Bush, before you make a venture like this, you say, look, I want to see every T crossed, every I dotted. I want to see where all the troops are going to be policing afterwards. I want a detailed plan. It looks like this thing was just put together by, you know, the comic opera of some sort. And so as I said, that can literally result in the loss of American lives. And apparently the administration is still, you know, saying, you know, we're doing okay, things are fine, we did the right thing.
Well, I think it's a tragedy, and I think it is going to cost an awful lot of more American boys' lives, not only over there, but when they get home, with their exposure to toxic chemicals and certainly their exposure to depleted uranium, which the government knows is a lethal product. It produces chronic renal failure and pulmonary problems and toxicity. And, of course, I believe that's one reason why so many of the boys from the first Gulf War are ill. But the government is refusing to allow any of these people to be treated because the last thing they want is for people to understand how dangerous depleted uranium is, because they want to be able to continue this very effective weapon that is so effective in killing people and destroying society. And they're really not concerned about the aftermath. They're not concerned about the civilians. The tragedy is they're not even concerned about our American boys. They want to be able to win wars, and there's no better weapon than depleted uranium, even though it may kill an awful lot of our boys as well.
Yes, unfortunately, there was a story of one soldier who had a special sort of secret assignment, within a day after transporting, which was probably what you're just referring to, his kidneys were failing and his liver failing and so forth, and I think there have probably been a number of those that they've covered up to some extent.
Well, you pointed out in the book The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein on page 194, Henry Kissinger made a remark of what the elite really feels, and Henry Kissinger represents the elite. Referring to the American fighting men, he said they're stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes. That's what the elite really thinks about our brave boys who went overseas to fight for freedom.
That's right, and that's why General Smedley Butler, a Marine general a long time ago, virtually said what you said. He said, I went into Mexico to make Tampico safe for the boys at Chase Manhattan Bank, and he really got sick of what he was seeing they were doing and manipulating soldiers. And you remember during the First World War when Lord Escher was talking to Morgenthau and said, we got to get American troops in there. We have to shed American blood as soon as possible so the president will get the U.S. into the First World War. So they've had, and in the Boer War, yeah, I mean, you know the whole history of how they will create these incidents and have our soldiers used for ulterior motives. And the ultimate goal, if I could broaden this out, is, of course, to move towards this world government. It'll be a world socialist government. And it not only has the military aspect to it that we've been talking about, but it has, you have to have all components. You have to have an educational component, an economic component, and so on. And so touching on each of those two briefly, what we had is, even though President Reagan got us out of UNESCO back in the 80s, and even though they are still, the UN Population Fund, supporting a particular AIDS, HIV projects, that, and if you look at the guidelines in those that it supports, I think it supports abortion on demand, same-sex marriage and prostitution even. So UNESCO's still a nasty outfit. However, on October 3rd, Secretary of Education Rod Page, our U.S. Secretary of Education, said how great it was that we were now rejoining UNESCO and that their World Conference, their Education for All initiative fit with President Bush's and Teddy Kennedy's No Child Left Behind bill. And then Rod Page went on to say a couple more things. He said, now we're going to have our children become, quote, citizens of the world, and education is the way you find your soul, and that we're going to have joint action with UNESCO.
And I think that's really what it's all about. It's all about the New World Order, the New World Religion. They're indoctrinating our children to become good little world citizens. This is the purpose of the No Child Left Behind legislation. It's not for excellence in education. It's to change the values and attitudes and beliefs of every child, and no child will be left behind. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Well, This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And let me just comment that Dr. Cuddy has written some wonderful books. And if you haven't read them, why, you've missed a great deal. His book, A Secret Records Revealed, is must reading. His book, Now is the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order, goes into the background of this move towards this world fascist society. His book, The Globalist, which unfortunately is out of print, is something I'm just hoping they get that back again, because it's filled with all sorts of important material. We carry his book on the NEA power grab, his book on the road to socialism, story of the Fabian socialist movement, which controls England and largely controls the United States, his book on the timeline to the New World Order from education, and then his two newest books, 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge. That's 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge and Cover Up. And if you're interested in any more information about them, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. Ask about the books written by Dr. Dennis Cuddy. They're must reading for anybody who's concerned about what's happening today and what sort of a life that children will have in the decades to come. So, Dr. Cuddy, why don't you go ahead and continue with your analysis?
Okay, since one of the things you just mentioned was 9/11, again, just like I was talking about, if we were serious with Iraq or Second World War or Vietnam and so forth, you look for certain things to see if we're serious, and apparently we're not, as you indicated about the loans to the Soviets during the period of the Vietnam War. What you look for in Homeland Security is, if we were really serious, we would make a greater effort to close that, at least, the southern border with Mexico, but it's still a sieve through which even Mexican officials have said some terrorists could come through. And the reason for that is there is an effort, part of the grand plan, the grand design, where to get the world government, you have a world economy, and to get the world economy, you have these regional economic arrangements. And so there have been discussions about joining the Canada, the U.S., and Mexico into a regional arrangement, not just through NAFTA, but militarily and in other ways.
Well, now, don't the new plans really call to take in much of Central America as well, the
yeah.
CAFTA agreements?
That's right. That's what they're headed for as we speak. There have been in negotiations for CAFTA as well. But in terms of Mexico and the U.S., the southern border being a sieve, the reason President Bush is initiating this growth in what's called the guest workers is to break down the barriers between nations, the borders between nations.
Hold that thought for just a moment, would you please, and we'll bring back our program. Okay, go right ahead there.
Okay, and so what happens is, when you look at it, the grassroots, first of all, we've lost a tremendous amount of manufacturing jobs, whether it's textiles, furniture, or whatever. Now, the reason they said, well, you know, we can do without those jobs is because we'll have these really high-tech jobs. Well, that's a lot of nonsense, because they're going to India and other places as well. Plus, our educational system is not really competitive with students coming out of Germany and other places.
Well, they're not even competitive with the students coming out of India. In fact, in India, they've been pushing excellence. Here, we've been pushing mediocrity. And this is not accidental. This has been done intentionally, just as the effort to ship our industries and ship our jobs out of this country has been intentional. But they can't let the American people know that. Why, they'd be furious if they realize that they are intent upon destroying the economy of this nation to impoverish our people and raise our living standard to that of the Chinese peasant.
That's right. And so not only do we lose the manufacturing jobs, not only did the high tech start going over to places like India, but then what you're left with is a lot of people who had been in these sort of textile mill towns, they go into the service industry, which at least they had. All right, but this guest worker program is really going to be the demise of that, because what's happening is this. And I've got a call from a fellow who had a carpet cleaning business in Missouri, but this affects construction workers, fast food workers, grass cutters, and so forth. I'll give just a quick example where I am. There used to be young African Americans who were grass cutters for condominiums, but they've been replaced by Hispanics from south of the border. Now, this isn't anti-Hispanic. They're really nice people. They're very hardworking. The problem is this. You have the American dream, the independence, the young African-American worker, and he's trying the best he can, small house, wife, child, right? Now, he has to pay his bills entirely, his utility bill, water bill, whatever. What the contractors are doing, and the ones who are really pushing this increased guest worker, is they in this specific case, got about 10 Hispanic workers. They have a house over the east side of town. It's like a dormitory. They're, you know, three per bedroom, three bedrooms, one on the couch sort of thing. And instead of paying, let's say, $100 utility bill like the young African-American independent family man does, they only have to pay $10 a month because they're sharing the expense. So they can literally live on a minimum wage. And so that is driving down the wages of even the service industry workers in America and in all of these, like I said, construction and so forth. Now, why is that? Well, that's been a plan from a long, long time ago. And you may have heard the term, the South will rise again after the Civil War, and, you know, there's a lot of these slogans. Well, let me read just this one thing and see if this doesn't ring a bell. This is a book from 1863. It's a long title, Pictorial National Records Embracing Descriptions of Europeans, Asiatic Nations, and the title goes on and on. But anyway, this is a quote from it. Remember, 1863. The ultimate object of the conspirators, that's the word to use, seems to have been, in the language of the historian Motley in his able letter to the London Times, quote, to establish a Gulf Empire, including Mexico, Central America, Cuba, and other islands, with unlimited cotton fields and unlimited Negroes. This is the golden vision in pursuit of which the Great Republic has been sacrificed, the beneficent Constitution subverted, end quote. And so what I ask your listeners to do is think about this. What do we have today? We have rule by an elite, which cares little for the constitutional preservation of our national sovereignty, and in NAFTA and the guest worker program, they have their unlimited cheap labor producing unlimited cheap products and services. So basically, this is the fulfillment of an elitist plan from years and years before.
Well, let's just mention for our listeners who are not well aware of what this is about, this is part of a plan put forward by the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation is financing LULAC and MALDAVE and the illegal alien organizations of illegal aliens here. We have an excellent video. It's called The Conquest of Aztlan, put out by Glenn Spencer, where he goes into the Ford Foundation's funding of this entire movement. Why did the Ford Foundation do this? For the same reason that back in the 1950s they were financing communist and socialist organizations here, because they really understand what communism and socialism is about. Stripped of all the idealism, this idea that they're going to redistribute the wealth of the rich. No, they're going to distribute the wealth of the middle class. Socialism and communism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory. It doesn't work without force, and somebody's going to be in control. Somebody's going to control the reins of government. That's why the wealthy encourage socialism. I mean, here we have John Kerry. His wife has $500 million of her own and controls a $1 billion foundation. Why is he such a socialist? Why? Because it's an elitist concept. And when you understand that, that it all begins to make sense. This is the world that Plato dreamed of when he wrote the Republic, of ruling oligarchy and the rest of us impoverished and poor. And that is exactly what is going on today. We also carry a book entitled Importing Revolution, going into the fact that Ford Foundation is funding so much of this, and I'm sure they probably have some help from the other great foundations and other elitists who are using the illegal immigrant situation to create a crisis, to lower our living standards, and of course when our living standards are low enough, why, people are not going to be concerned about these abstract ideas of freedom. It will simply be a matter of survival.
That's right, and since you mentioned communism and so on in connection with this, in my book Secret Records Revealed, I think around 1913, I put a quote from Stalin, and he's in Vienna, and he's talking about how this is 4 years before the revolution. He's talking about how they will break down borders, and that will allow them to achieve, without borders and nationalism, they will be able to achieve their theory of workers of the world uniting. You will have this larger purpose that Lenin called a disunion for the purpose of union. You have to break down and destroy these national boundaries in order to achieve your objective. And so Glenn Spencer, in his, either that video or one of his others, describes this as the Reconquista movement. where massive amounts come up and populate the southwestern U.S. And in terms of what I was just talking about, African Americans, on one of these videos that Glenn Spencer has, he literally has one of these leaders of the Reconquista Hispanic movement in California talking to a couple of African Americans, and this fellow is telling them to go back where they came from because this isn't their land, it's his.
And, of course, they've also told the whites, you better get used to think about going back to Europe because you're not going to be wanted here when we take over. And they're being, in fact, Cruz Bustamante, our lieutenant governor, was part of the Maldive movement when he was in college. Has the full backing of the Marxists and the communists, and but they're all being used. They're not smart enough to understand that their movement is being used by people far smarter than they are. The sort of people you find in the directorship of the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Council on Foreign Relations, who really understand what this is all about, and all of these other people are simply being used and will eventually be destroyed when they're no longer useful idiots.
Yeah, and since you mentioned Curry, what you need to stress here is that it's sort of like in Tragedy and Hope, Quigley's book, where he said, you know, kick the rascals out but not really change anything. What you have to remember is the power elite, they control your choice. So that if you don't like Skull and Bones member Bush, your choice is Skull and Bones member Kerry. But just like Clinton, Kerry and Bush, Kerry also voted for NAFTA. He also voted for GATT. So on that level, you're really not going to have much of a change. And that's how they operate. They control your choice. President Bush, for example, has appointed Skull and Bones members William Howard Taft IV, in the Council of the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, William Henry Donaldson, Skull and Bones members, Chairman of the Security and Exchange Commission, and so forth. And basically, what these people do in controlling the choice is what Quigley was talking about as part of their plan, set up by the Whitneys, actually, in the late 1800s, where they said we'll contribute to financially to both political parties and then have an alternation of power. So the stupid public thinks it has a choice when it really doesn't.
Well, Dennis, if I could just mention for our listening audience, Dr. Cuddy is referring to Professor Carol Quigley, who was a liberal college professor who taught at both Princeton and Harvard before he went to Georgetown University, and his most famous student was William Jefferson Clinton. Well, Professor Quigley wrote a book that Dr. Cuddy is referring to called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Came out in 1966. It was so good that somebody came in, bought up Macmillan, the publisher, and destroyed the plates to the first half of the book. But this book really lays out the whole plan of the elite to control America, indeed to control the world. And if you doubt the story about the destroying the place in the first half of the book, we have an interview with Professor Quigley in our Secret Government 4 tape set, where Professor Quigley tells just that, how they came in, destroyed the place in the first half of his book so it couldn't be republished, because they did not want the American people to know about the secret societies he wrote about, or this idea of a two-party system that was not at all different. Two parties exactly the same, controlled by the same people, to give the impression that we could throw the rascals out every 4 years, but the reality was nothing would really change.
That's right. Carol Quigley was, you know, all for this this system. It wasn't that he was some right-winger exposing these people. In fact, the word hope in his book was these people. He felt that these people, these elite, were the hope of the world. And so when he described William Whitney, who was a Skull and Bones member, and Whitney was a director of J.P. Morgan's Guaranty Trust. And so they had connections with big money people. And in terms of what's currently going on with Iraq, a lot of people are criticizing, and George Tenet was just on recently defending his agency. But a lot of Skull and Bones members, in fact, there was a New York Times article this past Monday, that mentioned that a lot of Skull and Bones people go into the CIA. And, for example, William Bundy, George H.W. Bush, the current president's father, William F. Buckley, Jr., William Sloan Coffin, Archibald MacLeish, a lot of these people with Skull and Bones have gone into the CIA. And so what you have is this network, and sometimes there's sort of a convergence of purposes. Because when you mention Clinton, of course, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Well, George Tenet was put into place by Rhodes Scholar David Boren supporting him to President Clinton. However, When Clinton leaves and George W. Bush comes in, then Senator David Boren, who's also a Skull and Bones member, puts on that hat and persuades the current President Bush to retain Tenet in that position. So there's this vast network, and there's convergences and interrelationships, and you even have Wesley Clark, who's a Rhodes Scholar from Little Rock, all of these players, so that what happens is they literally control your choice, and they do that way in advance.
Well, of course, Wesley Clark is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as is John Kerry.
Right.
Of course, George Bush is not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but of course, he appointed the people, all the people around him come from the CFR, including Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Alan Greenspan, in key positions. They all come from the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right, and Cheney, although he himself was not a Skull and Bones member, he's from a family which has Skull and Bones members. So there's this, as I say, this power elite which way in advance networks and works. Actually, that was Cecil Rhodes' plan. He said after 60 years they wouldn't need what he called a conspiracy in the hidden sense. It would be more what H.G. Wells called an open conspiracy, because he would have enough people. He said, we will penetrate education, journalism, politics, and economics, other areas, but those are the four main ones, so that after six decades or so, we won't need a, quote, hidden conspiracy. We'll have this network of like-minded people who will put others into place. And in fact, that's what Les Gelb, who is up until recently president of the CFR, said. He says, I talk about the New World Order all the time, he said, and I see one of my main jobs is getting good people, meaning, you know, liberal globalists like himself, into key government positions. And that's why of about 4,000 CFR members, there are 500 or 600 of them are in federal jobs in very key positions. And so this is how they control it. They not only control it in terms of personnel, like John J. McCoy said, you know, I'll flip through my little book and back in the 1940s and see who we can put in a key position, but they literally control the process. The process, and they do that way in advance. So you're really left with not much choice at all.
That's right. You have a choice of one of two candidates, and whichever one wins, whichever one loses, why the CFR's or the establishment's candidate always wins. In other words, they run a candidate on the Republican ticket, a candidate on the Democrat ticket, and you can have your choice. We have free elections. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We have time maybe for one or call if somebody has one. Otherwise, I'm sure that Dr. Cuddy has a great deal more to cover. But please just go ahead and pick up the story from there, Dennis.
Okay. It's what one of our mutual friends, John Loeffler, calls Socialist Candidate A and Socialist Candidate B.
Remember the Republicrats, right?
Right. And somebody in listening say, what? You know, I can understand Kerry maybe, but Bush? Well, what you got to remember is there's this sort of Hegelian dialectical process. And when you look at Bush, ask yourself, what is No Child Left Behind? I mean, it is an increasing federalization of education, which is supposed to be local control. And so we are tending to move in that direction. So although you can't say George W. Bush is a, quote, socialist, we're moving gradually in this dialectical process in that direction.
All right, we've got Ray calling on the line. Ray, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. The gentleman mentioned Secret Records Revealed. Is that a book?
Yes, it's a book that Dr. Dennis Cuddy has written, and if you'd like it, it is available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Okay, one more thing. The Bundy brothers, one of the Bundy brothers ran the Vietnam War for Lyndon Johnson, while the other Bundy brother ran the Ford Foundation. And both are Skull and Bones members.
You're absolutely right. That was McGeorge Bundy, who was National Security Director, and his brother, what was his brother?
William.
William, right.
One more question. He mentioned Tenet. Is Tenet a Rhodes Scholar or a member of what?
No, his position where he is, and there may be more than meets the eye, is all of these people have a backer or a groomer. In this case, it's Senator former U.S. Senator David Boren, who's now, I think, president of University of Oklahoma. He is both a Rhodes Scholar and a Skull and Bones member. So that's how he supported Tenet under Clinton, and how he asked current President Bush to keep Tenet as CIA director.
And you mentioned a New York Times article on the Skull and Bones. Do you have a date on that?
This past Monday, February 2, page A19.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, Ray. We're out of time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. Our guest this evening has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy. We mentioned his book, Secret Records Revealed. Now is the Dawning, the Globalist. Certainly of 9/11 prior knowledge, cover-up, and several other we haven't even mentioned, but they're so important you get his material. It's among the most valuable in my library of 20 or 30,000 books. Do you have a quick parting thought for our listeners?
Yes. As usual, nothing can be accomplished on our side in resisting this movement toward the world government unless there's prayer first, but secondly, be informed by listening to Radio Liberty as much as you can.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Dennis. Good night.
Tonight.
Okay, fine. And your guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we'll be back here in just a moment. Well, Dr. Cuddy is certainly one of my very good friends and a valuable source of information, and one of the few people who really has a grasp of how this all fits together. And a key to an understanding would be the work of Professor Quigley in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And this is really a very fascinating story because Professor Quigley was actually over in Great Britain shortly after the end of the Second World War, studying the British royal family and the British hierarchy of the economic and financial elite, wanting to know how they all fit together. And he came across a man named Professor Zimmern, who was a professor at Oxford University of International Affairs. And after that, they spent some time, and eventually they became fast friends. Professor Zimmern told Professor Quigley that he could not understand anything going on unless he understood there was a secret society that ran Great Britain and ran the United States. And Zimmern had been part of that secret society, and he swore, Professor Quigley, never to reveal who had given him the information. The only reason I know is because I went to Professor Quigley's papers back at the Georgetown University and was able to get the entire story there. But then Professor Quigley set out to document the existence of the secret society. He wrote a book called The Anglo-American Establishment, which he could not get published at all. Then he wrote another book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which was published back in 1966, and that's the one where somebody came in and bought up the Macmillan, the publisher, and destroyed the place in the first half of the book. I had the unique opportunity of spending weeks going through Professor Quigley's papers at Georgetown University and, of course, reading his letters back and forth to Zimmern and others, and so grasp how this whole fit together. In fact, we even were able to find a tape recording there of an interview Professor Quigley had done with a reporter at the Washington Post, where he tells the story of how his book was suppressed. He tells about how they destroyed the plates to the first half of his book so it couldn't be republished. He talks about these crazy right-wingers who honestly believe that there's a conspiracy out there and that the emblem on the back of the dollar bill is the emblem of the Illuminati. And as he says, why, that emblem has been around for 6,000 years, that emblem on the back of the dollar bill. And he's absolutely right. It's the emblem of the ancient mystery religions of which the Illuminati and the Masons, the Rosicrucians, and the Theosophists, and the other secret societies of today are simply modern-day manifestations of the ancient mystery religions. And, of course, that's all covered in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which you really need to get, you need to read, to understand how this all fits together. And really there is a brotherhood, multiple organizations with a common goal, a new world order, a new world religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because we need your help so we can gradually expand our coverage out across America. And as you know, this program, which has until recently been heard primarily in eastern Washington and here in the Monterey Bay area, and then across the nation on the Internet, is now being carried on shortwave all around the world. Every night for 2 hours, 5 nights a week. What a unique opportunity to reach people, but we need your help. We need your help talking to other people and, of course, getting them to start listening to our program on shortwave from 8 to 10 here on the Pacific Coast and 10 to 12 in Central Time. And, of course, if people don't have a shortwave, they can call us at 1-800-544-8927 and learn about certainly one excellent shortwave set. There are many of them, but people can always go to Radio Shack. But I think you might just give us a call and learn a little bit about the Sanjian type of shortwave radio. But what you need to do is get people to start listening either on the Internet where they can listen 5 hours a day or on shortwave where they can listen 4 hours a day. But you don't have to listen that often, because many times we'll have a same guest on several of our programs. Your job is to begin to learn about what's going on, to go to our website at radioliberty.com, to pull down our newsletters and read those newsletters. Of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And I suggest the December newsletter because it goes into the background of why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. Our January newsletter is really rather fascinating. It goes into the Illuminati and its influence in the United States and what George Washington said about the Illuminati here. What Timothy Dwight, the president of Yale University, said about the Illuminati in the United States. About a group known as the Clintonian Illuminati, which, of course, was founded, and we know it existed in 1802 because we actually got the material from the Jefferson Collection back at the Library of Congress. And we have so much documentation, and, of course, that material on the Clintonian Illuminati, Dr. Dennis Cuddy and I were able to get, although there was every opposition to our being able to get it. We were told it wasn't available, wouldn't be available for years, and one of these evenings we'll tell you how we managed to get that. But it is available through Radio Liberty, as is so much other material you will not find elsewhere. But the truth of the matter is, we're involved in a spiritual battle being carried out on a political and ideological and cultural and educational and financial battlefield. And our plea is to get people to learn what's going on, and then to become involved and join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. If I could make a suggestion, a video, Megiddo, the March to Armageddon is excellent. Diapraxia in the Church is a new video dealing with the church growth movement, which is sweeping across America with over 350,000 Protestant ministers and lay leaders having been absorbed into this system, which, of course, is aimed at changing our relationship to the Lord, changing the music and the message of the church. If you'd like to get the video, the Diapraxia in the Church, or our four-tape set on the church growth movement, which comes with a fair amount of literature that will explain what's really happening, at least you'll know, and hopefully you can talk to others. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, I don't believe that God will ever again bless this nation, and I fear the wrath of God on America. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And this evening we have, for this hour, Myrna Culbraith, who designed the Monopoly, and of course now she has put together something called she was the designer of the Phonics game, and now she's put together Phonopoly. And we're going to be talking about why it is, of course, that you can go to India today and you can find excellence in education. You can go to Europe and you can find excellence in education. You go to America, you find mediocrity in education. And it didn't just happen by accident. Why do you think so many of our really good jobs are moving overseas today? It's not only because, of course, they can hire people there very, very cheaply, but because they can hire people who have an outstanding education, because they have stressed excellence in India and in other countries. And here we've been stressing mediocrity and the sort of a society that you saw portrayed at the Super Bowl in the halftime last weekend. So, Myrna, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Yes, I'm so delighted to be with you, and I have to say I'm afraid we have to even reach up to reach mediocrity in this country. It has been pretty awful.
And, of course, what the people don't understand is they have deliberately dumbed down the children of this country, because they've taught them a method of reading that they knew would not work. So why don't you pick up and maybe give our listeners some of the background of why and how they were able to change the method of teaching reading that got us to the point where we are today.
Well, you know, they just slid a fastball past home plate, or maybe a curveball. When we say they, I'm talking basically about the progressive education movement, people like John Dewey. John Dewey probably would be the head of the list. He's generally regarded as the great philosopher of education. He was not so much a philosopher of education as of the political system that he advocated, which was, in effect, socialism. And if you'd asked him what he had advocated, he would have said socialism. He might have added democratic socialism, but it wasn't all that democratic. He went to Russia in 1927 when it was already abundantly clear that it was a murderous regime, and he came back without one word of criticism for Russia, in fact, with only praise for Russian education. And meanwhile, he was implementing in this country and advocating a method of reading that he knew from the turn of the last century, from 1900, did not work. In fact, he knew it two or three years before the turn of the century, because he tried it in a laboratory school. He was trying the whole word, memorize one whole word at a time method instead of what you have to teach, which is phonics. And he saw that it did not work. And interestingly, I don't know whether it's to his credit or his shame, he said, "We do not claim that by this method the children will learn to read as early or as well as by the old method, but we want to use the new method anyway." Now, to me, that's one of the more evil sentences in the English language. And brother, did he mean it. He went ahead to advocate, and there were a whole tribe of these people. He had a mentor who had another student who wrote a book extolling the virtues of whole word. Finally, in 1929, they got it adopted in almost all American schools. By the 30s, it was practically universal.
And so this was the Jane Run, and the whole idea of not sounding out the words as we were supposed to, as had been done in the 1800s and even before, but trying to memorize what a word would be, just like looking at a picture, like you were learning Chinese. And what they did was destroy the ability of a large numbers of children to ever be able to read and comprehend and spell and pronounce words correctly. We'll be back in just a moment with Myrna. Well, our guest is Myrna Culbraith, and just pick up the story from there, Myrna.
Yes, as a matter of fact, what they really did was, in less than a generation, they destroyed reading in this country. In fact, in a 5-year period, they destroyed reading. I will tell you a couple of figures on this. The world, you know, Tom Brokaw just recently wrote the book calling the World War II generation the greatest generation. Well, he had a point. And also, it was the last literate generation. And this is something most people don't know, unless maybe you or me, Dr. Stan, but in the World War II, when the men turned out for the draft in World War II, or to volunteer, as the case may be, less than 5% of them, about 4%, could not read well enough to serve. And most of those were people who were in the backwoods and basically never had a shot at learning, at even going to school, never mind learning to read. So that was all. And that's a, you know, that's a tolerable kind of percentage.
Yeah, we had 95% literacy is what you're saying.
Over 95% literacy, everybody was fine. It was the exception of people who never got to go to school. So, what happened? Well, World War II ended in 1945, only 5 years later, and the logistics of this work out with the introduction on a wide scale of the Run Jane Run books. They first were published in 1929. By the mid-30s, early 40s, they were practically universal.
But of course, our boys who went in the Second World War, they were joining up in 1941 and 1942, and many of them had been educated 5-10 years earlier.
That's right, and most of them, you know, 12 years before that, or 11 or 10, they were learning to read by the old readers that taught symphonics, so for the most part, they were fine. 5 years later, Korean War started in 1950, into World War II, 1945, or call it 10 years if you count from the beginning of World War II. But 5 years later, men turning out for the Korean War, they did not believe the test scores when they started to come in. They called in psychologists and psychiatrists thinking these men are faking, they're malingering, they don't want to go to Korea. Well, no, it turned out they were not faking. 20%, or a little over, could not read well enough to serve. Now, that's a fivefold increase. 500% more people could not read in a 5-year to 10-year period. And it was at the time when the age wave of people taught to run Jane Run stuff hit the recruiting effort in the Korean War. And it has only gone down from there, at least at the Korean War time. There were a few people who were teaching me.
Go right ahead.
And old Miss Smith, you know, down the hall was teaching phonics, whether anybody liked her or not. Young Miss Jones maybe was not, having been taught the wrong method in school. And so Miss Smith's students learned to read, and Miss Jones' kids did not. And nobody really knew what was going on. Parents were not informed of this. Nobody ever went to the parents and said, do you mind if we teach English as if it's Chinese? Do you mind if we teach memorizing whole words? Which we know produces guessing and misreading. I mean, they knew this. For example, the classmate of Dewey's, Dewey had a mentor, G. Stanley Hall, who also was the mentor of another man named Huey. You know, there was Huey and Dewey, and I'm not sure what happened to Louie, but maybe he was in there too. But it turned out this G. Stanley Hall, by the way, he was not a very nice customer either. He had a theory that the black races were the adolescents of humanity and ought to be taken care of but not heard from and little things like that. But meanwhile, the second guy, Huey, wrote a book in 1908 enthusing about the virtues of teaching whole words. And he said, it doesn't matter if a kid reads a pony instead of horse, because the meaning is the same, and it'll all come out in the wash in the end, everybody will be fine. No, they knew right then and there, and they admitted that it caused word guessing.
But I think really what's so amazing about this is that what this really involves is not using the brain properly. And, you know, through the years you've been able to find out, and now it's even been scientifically documented, that they're feeding the impulses into the wrong side of the brain so the brain is not functioning normally, which, of course, would not only influence its ability to read but to think and function correctly.
That's right, and it really literally does that. It is a form, you could call it a form of brain damage. And you can see it on brain scans. I've been saying for years, because I saw our students getting over it, and not only kids, but adults as well. And adults, you know, and in kids they're probably going to call it ADD or ADHD or dyslexia. In adults, it doesn't really have a name, but I named it the sleepy tired syndrome. And when I just say those words to a group of adult executives, you know, about half of their eyes glaze over, and pretty soon they raise their hands, usually more than half, saying, you know what, I get sleepy tired when I read. And what they don't know, I mean, they all then looked at each other in amazement, because each one of them thought, oh, it's just me, that's just how I am about reading. No, it's a whole syndrome, and it's caused, literally, and I used to say, I think if you could look into the brain with brain scans, what you would see is the wrong method has literally taught it to the wrong half of the brain, to the picture half, which is the right half. Because, you know, if you're teaching it as if the words are pictures, as if they're Chinese ideographs, and you have to memorize them, where is it going to go? To the picture recognition or pattern recognition half of the brain. However, you know, maybe it would have been okay, but it turns out that the right half of the brain doesn't even speak English, doesn't speak language, doesn't know what a word is. So now you're busy teaching reading to the half of the brain that cannot even talk, and then you wonder why anybody's got a problem. And what it does is set you up to have to recognize a word on the right, go over to the left, figure out what it means, where you do talk. The first thing they ever learned about left brain, right brain, was languages on the left side for virtually everybody. And so now it's going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it even sounds like it would put you to sleep. And it does. And so I was saying this, you know, with a well-founded speculation based on a lot of related brain research. But now there's direct, absolute confirmation of what I'm saying. I'm going to paste gold stars all over myself, Dr. Stan, for figuring this out to years ago. But now in the brain labs, and I on your morning or afternoon program sometimes when I've guest hosted, I've interviewed Dr. Sally Shaywitz two or three times, who's the head of the long-standing dyslexia project at the Yale University Medical School. She's out there with a new book called Overcoming Dyslexia. And what this book is saying, and what the brain labs, including hers but also others, are finding out now, they can look into the brain with brain scans. Sure enough, what they see is people are reading well and easily. Three areas in the left or language side of the brain light up, including one sort of in the back of the left side that is apparently the automatic processing that makes things easy. And on the other hand, if they're reading badly or they're labeled with dyslexia, etc., two big areas in the right half of the brain, one in the left, and the whole thing working about four times too hard. On the average, some are six or seven times too hard, and a few might be only a couple times too hard. But four times too hard, and then the real punchline is, catch this, just teaching phonics fixes it.
In other words, you can actually see on the PET scans that the activity shifts from the right to the left side?
The brain absolutely shifts to that normal, good left side, three areas, including the automatic processing and the back of the left side. Now, and by the way, the phonics methods that they have generally tested doing this, they get some improvement more fairly soon, you know, after several weeks or a couple months or something. And then in about a year, they get the further improvement all the way to basically normal. Now, with our method, what I have seen typically is it happens right away.
You're talking about with your Phonopoly,
Phonopoly
that you've devised, right?
Yeah. And, you know, for example, a classic story I tell that really tipped me off to this is a dentist came into our face-to-face seminars. This was with the precursor of both the phonics game and phonicsopoly that I had years ago. And here's a guy who went back to law school probably in his 50s. I never asked, but I would guess. And he had passed the law school. He passed the bar, and then he came to us. And, you know, so you know he's not a dummy, obviously. He's doing pretty well. But he said, you know, my spelling is lousy. I guess I could live with that. But I had to get the law degree reading 5-10 minutes at a time, getting up, walking around, pounding myself on the back to try to wake up. If I try to read at night, it's just totally hopeless. I just conk right out. and daytime isn't that much better. Could you do something about this sleepy, tired stuff? Because it's killing me. Well, at that point, I didn't know. So I said, don't know, but certainly helped your spelling, your comprehension. Plus, it's the whole logic behind the English language. Might as well take it. So he did, and the first day, Dr. Stan, for various scheduling reasons, we just played the first two games. It's what would be the first two games in Phenopoly. And if you looked at them, and you have, you'd say, yeah, that's pretty simple. Maybe I know some of that, but then maybe there's a couple things I wouldn't know. But he didn't even get to the third game that has maybe the most interesting rules of all, that most bright adults never even heard of. He didn't get that far. But one of the things we do, and if people get Phenopoly from you, this is something they should do. They should sound it out one sound at a time in those first couple games, because the left side of the brain likes to break things down one element at a time, put them back together. It likes to learn a rule. 2 + 2 = 4, and it'll do it today, tomorrow, and on Mars. So if you teach things that way, and that's what phonics, especially our phonics, does, that's telling the left side of the brain, hey, this is your kind of job. Take it over. Grab it. Get it. And it does. And you can actually literally do that. You can engage the right part, the right part, which in this case is the left side of the brain. So he just did that. He went home that night, not even having reached the most interesting part. And he thought, well, better get back to the seminar with a good night's sleep. I'll just read for 5 minutes. It'll knock me right out, as it always did. Lots of people say they use reading like a sleeping pill. Well, he picked up a book, confidently expecting to fall asleep. Not only did he not fall asleep, he could not put the cotton picking book down. He wound up reading all night long. Came in telling the story the next morning. And, you know, he said, I might have to prop my eyes open with toothpicks later, but I sure kept them open last night for the first time in my life. He'd read the whole book and got a couple hours sleep after dawn. So, you know, I knew then that something very profound had happened on the brain level. So I started looking for it, and I saw it happen to all kinds of people in our classes. I guess it had been happening before, and I just never quite, you know, some of us are a little slower than others. Takes a while to get the mule's attention. But that's what's been happening. And sure enough, now it's verified on the brain scans. Dr. Stan, I have something new for you that I think you would love to hear.
All right, why don't you tell me?
Here's a story. Here's an email I got. And you're part of this story, actually. You remember the teacher in Florida
the one who wanted to buy those, and I referred them to you.
Yeah, he wanted to get a purchase order, that kind of thing. Well, his school system eventually did buy them. He's been using them. He volunteered in a first grade class, even though he's a high school teacher, and he's been teaching those kids. And now I just got this email from Paul. He said, hello, Miss Myrna. On Tuesday, January 20th, I began working with a senior who is a legend for his reading trouble. He started playing Phonicsopoly. He is a popular football player who will not graduate unless he passes the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. Last Friday, January 23rd, that's 3 days later, he told me that the strangest thing was occurring. As he went through the day at school, when he saw text, his mind would be drawn into it. Quote, I would look at the words and I would just keep going. I wouldn't get tired. I could hear the words in my head. On Wednesday, January 28th, that's about a week after he started, he ran excitedly into my room. I took a science test today, Mr. Lukowski. I know I did good. It only took me a half hour to finish it. I even went back over the questions to be sure I had them right. I never did that before. What for? It didn't do any good. I could look at a sentence for 3 to 5 minutes and not know what it meant. It would take me the whole period to finish the test, 80 minutes. Yesterday, he told me that he received a 70% score on the science test. He had taken the same course 2 times before, failing the course both times, including all the tests. His highest score this year was a 28%. When a 30-year veteran teacher who knows this youth well heard the news, she literally could not speak. After a minute, she stammered, he has never passed a test on his own before in his life. Everyone knows he can't read. Cordially, Paul Lukowski.
Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful, really a testimony to what Phonicsopoly can do. And I'm sure it does, because, of course, we've moved many of them through my ministry. And we've just had so many wonderful, gratifying remarks and responses from people who've used it. We'll be back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Myrna Culbraith, and she is, of course, the designer of not only the Phonics game, which she no longer is has a financial interest in, but of Phonopoly, which, of course, she does produce and which is carried through Radio Liberty because we think it's so important that children have the opportunity to learn how to read and how to read phonetically. And this is the big problem that we have today. We have so many children who have been deliberately dumbed down in our schools. So why don't you pick up from there, Myrna?
Well, right. And, you know, I'm issuing a challenge, Dr. Stan, first of all, to parents, to adults for themselves. You know, I picked up from the Internet a little earlier this week from the New York Daily News, a columnist there, Richard Schwartz, wrote a very interesting little editorial. I'll read you just a piece of it. But he said, "Give schools a jolt. Let's launch a one-year all-out drive to cut illiteracy in half. Why do so many New Yorkers check their kids out of city schools if given the chance? Why do taxpayers flinch when asked to dump more dough into public education? Why do eyeballs roll every time the words school and reform appear in the same sentence? Because the public isn't convinced. Crime and welfare nosedive over the last decade, but illiteracy has hardly budged. Streets and parks are dramatically cleaner and more orderly, yet schools appear to be as unkempt and unruly as ever. Mayor Bloomberg and schools chancellor Joel Klein have staked their reputations on reviving city schools. Since taking control under the new state governance law, they have streamlined the bureaucracy and installed a new curriculum and generally given the sleepy system a welcome shaking up. What's needed now are results of the headline-grabbing kind. People want to see something that dazzles as they peer through the construction fence, something, say, like a radical reduction in illiteracy. Call it the New York Reads campaign." And goes on to say, "Must do this, and the unions and everybody should cooperate." Ends with, "Consider this the broken windows approach to illiteracy. Just as police jump on small offenses to drive down crime, educators would jump on even the smallest instance of a child's falling behind. Perhaps this reads like a pipe dream, but at bottom, students and teachers are desperate to succeed. To do so, they need a goal on which to focus their energies and intellects, a call to arms known as New York Reads." Well, Dr. Stan, I'm saying we need to have an America Reads program, and it can start with your listeners, like Paul Lukowski got his school system to order a few. Some teachers order them themselves and just plug it into the system, and then, you know, other people flock around, like, what do you think that 30-year teacher who knows this kid learned to read is going to do? And it is a kind of ministry, too, I think, Dr. Stanley. And Paul Lukowski thinks so, too. He cited me the example of, you know, it's like the beggar at the temple who was healed, and then they arrested the miracle worker, and they tried to suppress the story. They weren't too fond of getting stories out in those days, either. They should have had talk radio. But, you know, in spite of the fact they arrested everybody, Paul pointed out that others were saying, "Yeah, right, but, you know, we saw the beggar sitting at the temple crippled for 20 years, and now we see him up walking around. It's a little hard to suppress that story."
Well, I think, you know, the amazing thing is that it's not hard to teach children how to read properly. It takes a great deal of effort to dumb down our children year after year by using a system they know doesn't work. Phonics in 16 hours can modify the function of the brain and can teach the children how to read, and they will never forget it afterwards. It's simply a matter of doing that, and the fact that they refuse to do it and every effort to implement phonics is being blocked shows somebody wants to dumb down our children.
Well, I'm afraid so. We've got to take it into our own hands.
Just a moment. All right, fine, and I think you're absolutely right. Well, let's go to Ari, who's waiting patiently on the line. Ari is one of our supporters from up in Redwood City. Hi, Ari, how are you doing?
Hi.
Just fine.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Myrna, I'm wondering, how can a person such as myself determine whether I've had an adequate amount of phonics training? I started school in, I learned to read, that is, in the first grade in 1961, and I remember learning phonics, you know, learning the rules of how each letter of the alphabet sounds and so forth, and some of those rules of speech. But I also remember learning some of the Dick and Jane books, which I guess is some of the look-say techniques.
Right. Well, you know, that's a good question. That's a really good question, because most people don't know for sure how they learn, or they know they got some bits of phonics, but also the run, Jane, run. Probably the very best way is to actually get Phonixopoly and play it. First of all, no matter how much phonics you ever learned, this is going to be more than that, and it's more logical and in more orderly way, and in a way that just makes complete sense, and you sort of hit your head and say, why didn't anybody ever tell me that before?
I mean, there are a lot of basic rules in the English language, and I'll have to admit, a lot of these I never even thought of before. I mean, when is an AA or an AA, and how do you know which it is? And that's really one of the things you learn, and then, of course, it helps you not only the pronunciation, but in the spelling afterwards.
That's right, and the whole thing is built to come out with excellent spelling without memorizing, and lots of people wouldn't even know whether they've sort of got the sleepy, tired stuff or not. I mean, some people have it worse than others. Some people they get a little tired, or they just don't feel like reading that much. They just don't like reading quite as much as they wish they did. And some people really are okay, more or less, but hardly anybody knows some of the rules that we teach. A classic one that I often use as a little teaser rule is, and it's a rule that works on about 1 out of 4 English words, and I've asked it tens of thousands of people probably. For a long time I got a total of 3 answers. One was from Gene Roddenberry, the man who created Star Trek. Some of you know that my partner and I write Star Trek books, so I hung it on Gene one time when he came to give a pep talk to a class we were giving for Los Angeles Police Department. I said, Gene, you want to try my pet rule of phonics? You know, some people have a pet rock, I have a pet rule. So he said, sure, I'm game, and I asked him the question, and he had never heard the question. And I'm here to tell you, if Gene hadn't heard a question, it's just...
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a bad line for a second there.
Hello? I think we had a little...
we're doing fine. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Another question I had is, I tend to read at a speed of kind of like talking silently to myself. How can I learn to read faster?
Well, you know, a lot of the speed reading people are saying, oh, don't read to yourself as if you were talking to yourself. I don't necessarily say that. I mean, you can learn to speed that up some, but I'm not sure that I do not fully believe that you can do what a lot of the speed reading courses say and just kind of slide over the print and not hear it yourself.
You know, Harry, I can speed read. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.